Hello, fellow foodies. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you're listening to the Foodie Pharmacology Podcast. If you live in or have ever visited Atlanta, Georgia, you may be familiar with our vibrant food scene. Beyond our awesome food trucks, Atlanta is home to a growing community of urban farms, community food gardens, and proponents of the local food movement. The concept of eating local and with the seasons is really regaining popularity here. As a professor at Emory University, I teach courses focused on food, medicinal plants, and health. In my Food, Health, and Society course, I invite chefs, scientists, and community organizers to deliver guest lectures to the class. Chef Satterfield is a class favorite. Not only has he written a book on how to eat locally in his cookbook, From Root to Leaf, he also recently authored a short stack edition recipe book on the botanical ingredient that is the topic of this episode. So I hope that you enjoy this podcast as we explore a South American crop that has made its way into the local food movement of Georgia. Plus, in our interview, Chef Satterfield is going to share some of his favorite recipes with me and you. So let's dig in. In our 11th episode on the show, we're going to investigate an herbaceous legume that is transformed into a variety of classic American foods. As a child, I loved eating whole spoonfuls of its rich, buttery form, maybe topped with a bit of honey. It is the base ingredient of the American classic P&J sandwich. Others have served it as a snack in its roasted, salted, or seasoned form, or even in its whole boiled form. Baseball games simply wouldn't be the same without this classic snack. In other countries, it is used in stews and sauces, or as a crunchy topping to a number of Asian dishes, including pad thai. Although it's called a nut, this does not grow on a tree. Do you know which crop I'm talking about? If you guessed the peanut, you'd be right. Peanuts are sold boiled, roasted, as a flour, or even a cream, and are commonly used to produce an edible oil. Regarding its specific culinary uses, peanuts are used widely throughout the world and are one of the principal oil seeds, as well as a high-quality food for human consumption. Peanuts are also used as livestock feed. After removing the pods, the tops of the plants are used as hay, although the entire plant may also be used. Beyond food uses for humans and animals, peanut products touch an astonishing array of industries. For example, peanut oil products are used in some paints, varnishes, lubricants, and even insecticides. The peanut shell has been used in manufacturing of glue, fuel, wallboard, and even plastics. Some of the most transformational work on the science of peanut cultivation and use was undertaken by an African-American scientist, George Washington Carver. George was born a slave in 1861, and after the Civil War and his freedom, he pursued an education, later becoming an agricultural chemist and agronomist who encouraged the growth of alternative crops to cotton in the South, like peanuts and sweet potatoes, to prevent the depletion of soil quality. Carver was credited with an almost sole responsibility for the rise in U.S. peanut production in the South following the boll weevil destruction of the cotton crop in the late 1800s. Peanuts provide a rich source of essential nutrients and vitamins, including dietary minerals, vitamin E, B vitamins, magnesium, manganese, phosphorus, and dietary fiber. For every 100-gram serving of peanut, there is 25 grams of protein and 570 calories. The nutritional value of peanut has become evident in campaigns aimed at treating children that are suffering from severe cases of malnutrition in the developing world. Products like Plumpy Nut, which is a 3¼-ounce packet of peanut paste developed by the French company Nutricet, can be used to support rapid weight gain and broad nutrient intake for children at risk of illness or death due to starvation. The scientific name of peanut is Arachis hypogaea, and it is a member of the Fabaceae, or legume or bean family. The modern peanut that we cultivate today is thought to have arisen from the hybridization of two wild species, Arachis duranensis and Arachis ipiensis. This annual herbaceous plant is native to South America, in Argentina and Bolivia, where its primary crop center of origin is located. It has been cultivated in pre-Columbian native societies of Peru as early as 3000 BC. Peanuts were probably brought to West Africa from Brazil in the 16th century, and from there to the African East Coast and to India and Asia. Today, there are many different cultivars of the peanut now cultivated across the globe, and this includes thousands of land races. Peanut plants can grow to a height of 30 to 60 centimeters. Peanut has a fascinating reproductive cycle. It is just one of a few hundred species of legumes that produces flowers above the ground, but then develops the fruit below the ground in a process called geocarpy. Its flowers require 2 to 3 months for development, and after pollination, the fruit-bearing part bows down to the bottom, to the ground, and grows into the soil, and it preferentially grows into easy-to-break-apart sandy soil. Once there, the fruit develops within 2 months to complete ripeness. Peanuts are cultivated in regions with a median temperature of 72 degrees Fahrenheit or 22 degrees Celsius. Growing up in the Southeast U.S., I always assumed that this was the major center for peanut production. But man, was I wrong. Believe it or not, China actually leads production on this groundnut crop, producing a whopping 16.6 millions of tons in 2016 alone. India produces 6.9 million tons, Nigeria produces 3 million, and the U.S. just produces 2.6 million tons. So this classic American snack is more prominent in cultivation in Asia than it is in the Americas today. Are you familiar with the health benefits of resveratrol? You usually hear about them in association with the consumption of red wine. But resveratrol is also found, get this, in peanut skins. Resveratrol is a plant phenolic compound that has been extensively studied for its health-benefiting effects. There are many in vitro and animal studies that have demonstrated the impact of resveratrol on inflammatory cascades that are important to chronic disease. Most of the clinical trials conducted on resveratrol have focused on cancer, neurological disorders, cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and obesity. A review of clinical trials on this compound, on resveratrol, however, revealed that its efficacy can vary depending on the condition tested and on the specifics of the patient population under study. Regardless, a glass of red wine contains about 1 milligram of resveratrol, and a 3.5 ounce single serving of raw runner peanuts with the skin intact also has about 1 milligram of resveratrol. Boiled peanuts have about half of that, and peanut butter, on the other hand, only has around 0.07 milligrams per serving. So the lesson here is that you don't necessarily have to have that glass of red wine to get some resveratrol into the diet. Have a serving of peanuts instead. Now, there's one big topic that we haven't yet addressed when it comes to peanuts, and that is the peanut allergy. Peanut allergy is one of the most common food allergies, and this is especially important to children in Western countries where it's more prominent. As a parent of young kids over the past decade, I've become more aware of peanut allergies and the risks that come with them. If you've ever received a notice that there is a peanut allergy in your child's class, please, please take it very seriously and keep any and all peanut-related foods at home. The physical symptoms of an allergic reaction to peanuts can range from itchiness and hives all the way to a drop in blood pressure, heart attack, and anaphylaxis. In other words, encounters with this food can have deathly outcomes if exposed to a child that's very sensitive. And recommendations need to be taken extremely seriously. While the route of exposure through unintentional ingestion is a key one to look out for, there are other ways that children can become exposed. For example, external exposures can also elicit an allergic reaction, and this could be through inhalation or even skin contact to peanut butter particles. So make sure that you send your kids to school with clean shirts that do not have peanut butter smeared on them. The cause behind peanut allergy is still unclear, but there are several allergenic elements that have been identified. There are skin prick tests that are available to test for peanut allergies, and there are oral food challenges that can be undertaken under the direction of a specialist, and these can be used for diagnostic purposes. Unfortunately, there is no cure currently for peanut allergies. Though carefully conducted clinical studies evaluating the introduction of peanut allergens through low-dose skin patches, sublingual immunotherapy trials, and injections are currently underway. To learn more about peanut allergies, a good resource to check is FARE, spelled F-A-R-E, and this is short for the Food Allergy Research and Education website, available at www.foodallergy.org. Peanuts have had a huge impact across the world. In some cases, this crop is a life-saving source of nutrition, while in others, for children that have allergies to it, it can actually cause great harm. Regardless of whether you love or avoid this plant, one thing is certain. Americans have a long fascination with the peanut crop, and it has become ingrained into the social identity of our food culture. I wanted to take this opportunity to learn more about the ways that peanuts are integrated into different dishes. Lucky for me, I happen to know a chef who just released a book on this very topic. Chef Steven Satterfield is the executive chef and owner of Miller Union, an award-winning, seasonally driven restaurant located in Atlanta's West Side neighborhood. Since opening in 2009, the restaurant has received various honors on many national lists, including Eater, Bon Appetit, Food & Wine, Esquire, and the James Beard Foundation. In 2015, Satterfield released his first cookbook, Root to Leaf, to a broad critical acclaim. Peanuts, which is his second book, is a delightful collection of recipes that offers ingenious ways to cook peanuts, from childhood snacks to kitchen condiments and even to the centerpiece of a meal. Satterfield's dedication to seasonal cooking and his unwavering support for local farmers is a driving philosophy behind his restaurant and everything he does. So I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did with Steven at his home.
So I'm super excited to be here with Steven Satterfield. He has a new book out. It's called Peanuts, and it's perfect for the topic of this show because today we're talking about peanuts in cuisine and in health. And this is a short stack book. Steven, do you want to introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I'm Steven Satterfield. I'm the executive chef and co-owner of Miller Union here in Atlanta. I'm also the author of Peanuts Short Stack Editions. Mm-hmm. So Short Stack Editions is a series that focuses on a single subject with about 20 to 25 recipes for each booklet. And each one is a different author. So it's one author, one subject.
That's awesome.
I think they have about 30 volumes now. So it was a fun project. In fact, when this came out, I did meet with the National Peanut Board, which is based in here in Atlanta. And after they saw the finished copy, they bought 5,000 copies.
That's amazing.
So they're using it as a marketing tool.
That's great. And this is not your first book, though, either.
No, I have another book called Root to Leaf, and it's a 500-page anthem to the vegetable world, and it's all about cooking with seasonal produce and kind of a farmer's market guide for the home shopper.
That's great. I'm a huge fan of the book. I have one at home and try and use it in my cooking around the seasons. It's really great.
Excellent.
Cool. So I guess let's start with the peanut itself and what drew you to this particular crop for this short stack edition?
Sure. Well, a couple of reasons. One is that I'm from Georgia, and Georgia's the largest producer of peanuts in our country. Also, I had a peanut section that was in Root to Leaf that got pulled by the publisher because it was too regional. So it was semi-developed already. So I actually pitched this to Shortstack because I know the producers of the series, and they were interested in following up, and we started talking, and next thing you know, this was happening.
So can you tell us a little bit about the recipes? Do you have things like from snacks to main courses?
Sure.
What are some of the ways that you like to prepare peanuts?
Well, peanuts are incredibly diverse, and they lend themselves to many different applications, anywhere from a homemade peanut butter recipe to snacks, desserts, entrees, vegetable sides. So there's a lot of different styles of preparations in there. And also there's some that are very colloquial to the Southeast, and there are some that are very international because peanuts are grown worldwide.
One of my favorite snacks as a kid was obviously, you know, peanut butter, even peanut butter on a stick or peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah.
Could you tell us how hard is it to make peanut butter from scratch?
So that's a good question. When I was attempting to do it just on my own without looking at any recipes, it was a bit of a disaster. And I actually was going to say in the book, you know, maybe this isn't something that you should do, just get your favorite peanut butter. But then I talked to a friend who is also helping me test some of the recipes, and she was like, oh, I've got a great recipe for homemade peanut butter. And it was really so simple. It was just about, you have to incorporate oil when you're making peanut butter because it's just too dry. And that's what gives it that creamy consistency, that spreadable consistency is the addition of extra fat. And so that's how peanut butter is made. It's typically, the main three ingredients are roasted peanuts, salt, and oil. And then there can be other additives like sugar or, which a lot of commercial peanut butters have sugar added to them. But I don't see any reason to do that. I think it's just better just to make it clean and natural. And then if you want to add a sweetener on your own, then you do that. Yeah.
Now, have you played around with different oils, or is there a certain oil that's used for this?
Well, peanut oil is the obvious choice.
Yeah.
Peanuts are very rich in fat, but to make it spreadable, you do need that additional fat. So peanut oil is complementary because it has a similar flavor. And particularly, you want to try to get an expeller-pressed or cold-pressed peanut oil that has a cleaner flavor, but it also has no chemical additives. And, but you could, I mean, and if you look at peanut butter jars, it's often, soybean oil or canola oil or cottonseed oil. So, I mean, I think it's just whatever is cheap on the market at that time.
Okay. Wow.
That's why it's nice to make your own, because you know what goes into it.
You know exactly, exactly what's going into it.
And you know, peanuts are, they are really susceptible to, fungus and when they're growing in the ground. So they are often sprayed with fungicides, and if there are some organic peanuts out there, they're a little harder to find, but you can definitely find them in a natural food store or the organic section of the supermarket. So if that's something that you're concerned about, then you can definitely find organic, and that's always a good
one to
bet.
Know,
you know, it's not been sprayed with anything.
Yeah.
Anything chemical. And I think peanuts are an interesting topic because a lot of people don't realize that they're not actually a nut, but they're a legume. And in the legume family, you have beans, peas, lentils, all those things. And they have that characteristic kernel that is split in two when it's cooked. And so it's sort of like a bivalve, but it's a legume. And peanuts have this really interesting characteristic when they're growing. Unlike any other legume, when the flower starts to form, the stamen is quite heavy, and that's what eventually forms the actual peanut, the kernel, the shell. And the heavy stamen weighs the flower down, and then it touches the ground, and the flower stem continues to grow, and it pushes the flower and the stamen into the ground.
That's amazing. So it's not the root. It's actually, it is the fruit.
It's the fruit.
But it's being pushed into the ground.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's genetically coded by nature to do that. And yeah. No one really knows why, but that's just the way peanuts grow. So they're in the legume family. All of the other legumes grow into pods that mm-hmm. have edible kernels inside. And some of them have edible pods too, like this, like the snow pea.
Yeah.
But, or the sugar snap pea, which is a hybrid of a snow pea and a English pea. But the peanut is unique in and of itself because of that characteristic where it goes underground and it continues to form underground. It also has that very, telltale shell with the cross hatches on it. Mm-hmm. And you see those pictures of the cartoon of Mr. Peanut.
Yes.
And he's got that kind of hourglass shape and the cross hatch skin. And there are many varieties of peanuts. A lot of people don't realize that. I think there are four main varieties, but outside of that, there's a lot of sub varieties.
Yeah.
And
I think they were domesticated too in South America, which is
right.
where they originated. And mm-hmm. so I know in South America you have many different varieties that small farmers really
Absolutely.
Chose and selected for, and then some of those went into commercial production down the line.
Yeah, yeah. And the U.S. is very much known for getting on the bandwagon of one particular variety and growing mm-hmm. a lot of one and
yeah.
monoculture kind of aspect to farming. But you're right, in Peru, I mean, think about not only peanuts, but potatoes. They have so many different varieties that we've never even heard of.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating. I mean, almost every edible plant has many, many species or varieties available that we don't even know about because we're so monoculture oriented here. So the main peanut varieties that we see in the Southeast are the runner peanut, which is a small variety with a nice sweet flavor to it. There's also the Valencia. This one is a smaller production, and you see more grown in the Southwest with New Mexico and Texas. Then there's the Spanish variety or the redskin peanut. Mm-hmm. And then the Virginia peanut, or also called the colossal, and that's the kind that's much larger and has a great sweet flavor. And then also the way that we, majority of the time we see peanuts, they have been shelled and dried.
Mm-hmm. Or even roasted in some cases as
yep.
well.
Mm-hmm. So, or dried in the shell.
Oh yeah.
And so those are the main, usually you see peanuts that have been dried.
Mm-hmm.
When they're harvested, it's in the summertime, and it's usually mid to late summer that the peanut harvest is going mm-hmm. on. And green peanuts are sort of a delicacy in the South in the sense of green peanut meaning that it's freshly dug and it hasn't been dried yet. So
okay.
those are very unstable. They have to be
it's a short
washed.
Shelf life.
Yeah, they have to be washed mm-hmm. immediately and held either refrigerated or frozen mm-hmm. until ready to use. And refrigerated, I think maybe they last 2 or 3 weeks before they start to grow mold.
Mm.
And frozen, they'll last for up to a year. So I actually had the pleasure of visiting a peanut farm during my research of this short stack edition. And I went to Hardy Brothers Farm, and I met them through the Southern Foodways Alliance. And there's a great short film about them that Joe York produced for SFA. So I got their contact through the SFA and made an appointment to see them. And it was really cool just to see what it's like on a peanut farm. I mean, it
yeah.
is probably some of the hottest conditions in Georgia. middle Georgia and middle South Georgia is kind of where
so peanut, below the gnat line, then.
Peanut,
yes.
peanut land is. And it was a beautiful drive, actually. I went from Atlanta, and you kind of cut over to the middle part of the state, just above Macon,
okay.
and head your way down. And there's pecan groves and peanut fields and cotton fields everywhere. It's definitely like mm-hmm. the heartland of the state, and soybean fields too. So went to the farm and got to see them actually digging the peanuts up, and then the whole process of cleaning them. And it's all mechanized in their
yeah.
facility, because they're a pretty big peanut producer, and they sell... They export peanuts to other states, but they also sell to supermarkets. And so you can buy They're green peanuts.
Oh, wow.
Fresh or frozen at like Publix and and Kroger and things like that. And then they also make their own boiled peanuts as a value-added product.
Yeah.
And they sell those in the supermarkets as well.
I mean, growing up in South Florida, one of my favorite things to do, that if I was ever on a road trip with my dad, is there were always these boiled peanut salesmen on the just on the side of the road.
Oh, yeah. Same in South Georgia where I grew up. Yeah.
We would get a big bag of, you know, the chili pepper flavor, you know, Cajun boiled peanuts or salted peanuts. Oh, it was so tasty.
If I can just read you the first paragraph of the introduction.
Excellent.
To this book. If you ever find yourself driving down a rural road in the southern United States during the middle of the summer, you're most likely see a hot boiled peanut sign along the way. I suggest you pull over and grab a bag so you can experience one of the South's finest rituals.
Yes, that's exactly it. It's like the best memories of childhood. We're just munching on these peanuts on the road.
Exactly.
That's great. So when you're talking about fresh green peanuts, so fresh harvested, how do you cook them? Besides making them as boiled peanuts, are there special dishes that you really enjoyed from your exploration of the green peanut?
I think boiled is the best way to go for the green peanut because it's going to tenderize the peanut. I mean, you could certainly just peel them raw and do something different with them, but there's something really unique about the texture and flavor of a boiled peanut that I think it's really one of the best applications for the green peanut, whereas the dried peanut, it's, you know, you can tend to get that more crunchy.
Yeah.
And the boiled peanut, the green peanut, it's nice to sort of capitalize on its tenderness while it is still raw.
Yeah.
So that's generally the way I explore the green peanut. But in Short Stack Editions, we also looked at peanut oil, peanut flour,
tell me a bit more about that. How is that made and how do you use it?
Peanut flour is really just a byproduct of making the oil. For expeller pressed peanut oil with no solvents or chemical additives, there is basically a nut meal that is defatted, and it's basically the solids of the peanut.
Okay.
And it has a lot of protein. It has great characteristics. I actually have a pasta recipe, homemade pasta recipe in here that is just eggs, pasta flour, and peanut flour.
It's like a super protein pasta.
Yeah, it's really nutty and delicious and a little bit sweet. And I did it with some roasted broccoli and Parmesan. And it's a great vegetarian dish with a lot of protein. And peanuts really are incredibly nutritious. They're high in copper and zinc and magnesium. They have a lot of protein. They have good quality fat.
I think this is why they're also used as really almost like a medicinal food for people that are recovering from periods of starvation or hunger or famine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is really big in those kind of development efforts.
Yeah, I mean, just one tablespoon can provide so much nutrition and well-rounded nutrition. And, you know, George Washington Carver was obsessed with the peanut, and he really was, it was one of the most fascinating ingredients to him. He was a scientist that studied the peanut and really kind of developed all these different uses for it. And he's credited with coming up with peanut butter.
Okay.
Which was really basically a fast and easy way to ingest high quality nutrients in one spoonful.
Yeah.
But he also had ideas for using the plant and the shells and, you know, all kinds of different things. I mean, I think he had over 100 ideas of different ways you could use the peanut plant. So
it's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we explore in this show is the movement of plants and how certain ingredients have become embedded in different cultures. And I think the peanut's a great example of that, because if you look at its origins in South America, its relevance now in southeastern U.S. cuisine, and then also in Africa and into Asia, everyone has a special way that they kind of incorporate peanuts in their cuisine, and they really do play a star role.
It's really true, and it's fascinating to see how each culture embraces the peanut mm-hmm. and uses it in such diverse ways. Because yeah. it is so, it's kind of a chameleon ingredient. It can really mm-hmm. Work with so many different flavor profiles. It can add texture. It can add body if you're pureeing it. I think there's an African peanut soup that is a very common thing to see in mm-hmm. West Africa. It's very often used in South Asian cuisine as well. So it's really fascinating to see all the different uses for it. I'm a little less familiar with some of the South American preparations mm-hmm. where it originated.
Yeah.
Because they're that type of food is less popular in our culture.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm thinking of like with Southeast Asian and Asian cuisine, they're using both the oil mm-hmm. and they're using the roasted nuts as kind of a condiment and topping
yes.
as well. And oftentimes they're pairing it with chili peppers, which yes. again are another American plant that's spread across the globe and right. really made a big impact.
I think peanuts and chili are a great flavor combination mm-hmm. together. I definitely have that reoccurring in the short stack edition. I think mint is a great complement to peanuts.
Interesting. I've never heard
of that. And there's one dish that we serve at the restaurant that has become very popular, and we do it every late summer when the green peanuts are in season. So we make a big batch of boiled peanuts and shuck them. Mm-hmm. And then it's also the same time, same season for field peas and butter beans. Mm. And so we'll do blanched field peas and or butter beans and toss them with the boiled peanuts.
Yum.
Wow. They're both legumes.
Yes.
And they pair well together. And the peanuts kind of bring out the nuttiness, the nutty quality of, mm-hmm. of all of them. And then the butter beans or the field peas, you know, kind of remind us of that soft, starchy texture that mm-hmm. the peanut has. They really complement each other. And we do just a little bit of lemon ricotta on the bottom of the plate.
Okay.
And we toss those, that legume mixture with some roasted tomato and roasted pepper, and finish it with chopped roasted peanuts, the crunchy ones.
The crunchy ones, okay.
And some fresh mint.
Nice.
And it's almost like a Southern style chot.
Yes,
And it's really just a wonderful dish that has a huge popularity at the restaurant. We serve it probably every July, August, and sometimes into September.
I can see why it would be popular. Yeah. Sounds amazing.
It's pretty yummy. I think when it's on the menu, I eat it like at least 3 or 4 times a week.
That's great. Well, you mentioned something just a moment ago about in season and seasonality of foods. And I know that this is a huge passion of yours. And I wonder if you could just expand a bit more broadly about why is eating in season important for the quality of the flavor and also, you know, the relevance that has to our health?
Sure. Well, I think I would like to just take a step back and, mm-hmm. and look at our culture for a minute. The way that we approach fruits and vegetables is that we kind of expect that all of them should be available at all times.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, that's kind of the supermarket way of thinking. I encourage people to, if they have a local farmer's market, to explore the farmer's market mm-hmm. and pay attention to the seasons. And that's what I've been doing for mm-hmm. years, and that's how I like to cook. And so when we work with farms, we work with what they have, and that's what dictates our menu.
That's great.
And so if something's not in season, we'll just not have it. And a great example, a very common example, is a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a tomato any time of year, but the very best tomatoes are going to be June, July, August. September yeah. is a great month for tomatoes too. People sometimes don't understand why we don't have a tomato on one of our sandwiches. When we'll have it in the summer, we won't have it in the winter. Well, we just don't feel like it's a good match because
yeah.
they don't taste good.
I try to encourage my students to do this, to compare, you know, the flavors of things, because you know, if you taste something that's vine ripened and fresh and in season, compare that to something that's been harvested green, shipped across the world,
maybe gassed, yeah,
to force it to turn red. I can guarantee you, as someone that knows a lot about plant chemistry, that the chemistry of those two ingredients are going to be vastly different, and yeah. we taste that in our food.
Yes, we're not dummies. We can figure it out on our palate.
Exactly.
And so the more we pay attention to seasonality and trying to live by that mantra, it's a healthier lifestyle because you're getting fresher nutrition. If you're eating locally, you're getting things that weren't shipped across the country or from another country. Mm-hmm. One of my pet peeves is asparagus. It's really, truly only available in the spring. Mm-hmm. But you can see it year-round, and it comes from shipped from very far away,
yeah,
from other parts of the hemisphere.
Wow.
And, you know, and that's something to consider because they're really as delicate as a fresh cut tulip.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the kind of thing you want to eat it as soon as you can after it's been cut.
Yeah.
And the more and more time that a fruit or a vegetable spends away from its food source, which is the home plant, mm-hmm, the host plant, the less nutrition it has. It starts to deteriorate. It starts to die. So all these things that we're eating are living things.
Yeah.
And as they get further away from that moment where they were snipped from their host plant, they're not going to, they're best right at that moment. And the longer the time passes, the further it travels, the less nutritious it is.
It makes me think of figs. You know, as a kid, I hated figs. I thought they were horrible because I'd only had them when they were kind of shriveled up and you know, you find them in the supermarket. And when I had the opportunity to taste them from an actual fig tree.
Yes.
I was blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, how have I been missing this in my entire life?
Yeah.
It was just, you know, just such a huge difference and so delicious.
Yeah, that's very true. And fig is a fascinating subject.
Yes. I've got to do another episode.
They're pollinated by little tiny fig wasps.
And then so you have bugs
like
inside of them. Yeah, and all their flowers are kind of taste inside.
Yeah, it's figs
are
fascinating.
Fascinating. Yeah. That's great. So for the audience in foodie pharmacology, I guess one of their questions would be, you know, as a chef that knows a lot about local foods, like what are the steps that they can take? So you mentioned going to local
farmers markets yeah,
and kind of getting in sync with what is the natural rhythm of crops in their particular area, wherever they live,
exactly,
in the country or in the globe. I know we have some international visitors, listeners as well. So what other advice do you have for them? I think one of the struggles is maybe we don't always know how to cook local foods.
True.
So
one bit of advice is get a copy of Root to Leaf, and it might help you through through the seasons. But also, I think it's great to buy something that you've never cooked before.
Mm-hmm.
If it looks pretty and you just want to try it, buy it. And there's so many online recipes now.
Yeah.
If you don't have my book and you just want to Google, like, how do you cook kohlrabi or what do you do, mm-hmm, with Swiss chard, or, you know, I've never cooked dandelion greens before. Like, just Google it and find some recipes that sound good to you. I mean, just read through the ingredients. That's what I do sometimes when I'm looking for a new idea. And I'm stumped, I'll just start reading other people's recipes and I'll be like, oh, okay, I never thought about pairing, you know, pine nuts with dandelion, but that sounds delicious. Maybe I'll take that and run with it. I won't even look at the recipe anymore. I'll just get an idea
and then
start playing around with a new pairing.
That's very cool. So I have to ask, out of all of your recipes in the short stack, which is your personal favorite? Was it the one you mentioned before, the one that served?
That's a good one, but you know, I think my surprise favorite was this one. It's a fish recipe.
Oh.
And so you make a coconut rice,
mm-hmm,
and this is kind of an Indonesian inspired stew. And I made a broth with onion and sweet pepper and tomato and peanut butter. And it has some turmeric, paprika, lime, and lemongrass in it. And then, once the stew is finished and I pureed it, then you put bits of bok choy and pieces of fish and just slow simmer it until, mm-hmm, the bok choy is tender and the fish is cooked,
mm-hmm,
and serve it over the coconut rice with some cilantro and some crunchy peanuts on top.
That sounds amazing.
Really, really delicious. And it was sort of like it was one of those things I had the idea for, but I hadn't made it. And I said in the header here, I tested this Indonesian-inspired stew on my family while we were vacationing at the beach, and I warned them, I have a deadline and we need to eat this tonight. Although I was met with some skepticism at first, they loved the dish, and this recipe became an instant hit. It really is one of my favorites in this volume. The tender pieces of snapper are lightly poached and enveloped in the peanut butter tomato lime broth, and the bok choy adds a juicy crunch and boosts the vegetable factor.
Awesome. Wow. That sounds amazing. I want to go vacation next door. Can I come over for dinner? No. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show, Steve. This is really fascinating. I think I'm going to have to try out some of these recipes with my kids because they're huge fans of peanuts. And yeah,
great.
Sounds amazing.
Sounds good.
Thanks. Okay.
Who knew the peanut could be so fascinating? And that it's not even really a nut, botanically speaking at least. So what is your favorite peanut dish? Whether it's being munched on as a snack at a ball game, served as a cocktail snack, smeared onto bread and made into a sandwich, or gobbled up boiled and salted or maybe even Cajun seasoned, I hope that the next time that you enjoy this fabulous legume with friends, that you'll share some of the interesting pharmacology and history with them as well. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, we'll investigate a mint with a unique lemony scent. It's currently growing in my home garden, and I just love crushing the leaves and taking in a deep breath to savor its unique aroma. That may be because of its medicinal effects as well. This hardy herb is used in traditional medicine to reduce stress and anxiety. So join me next time when I'll be discussing one of my favorite non-caffeinated herbal tea plants of the spring, Melissa officinalis, or lemon balm. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. Get updates on our latest episodes by following or liking the Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. Spread the word. Give us some ratings. We need some comments and feedback on these sites. Tell your friends, too. If you've got a great idea for a future show, reach out to me. You can find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page or on Twitter or Instagram at Quave Ethnobot, spelled Quaveethnobot. See you next time.